of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is in the matter of the estate of Clifford Mellon, deceased, for the appellant, Department of Social Services, State of South Dakota, is Mr. Daniel J. Chodd, an Assistant Attorney General from Pierre, and for the estate, Mr. Gordon Nielsen, an attorney from Sisseton. The court would like to note the presence and welcome the eighth grade students from George Morris Middle School across the street, Mrs. Byerly's class. We hope you find this an informative hour. So, with that, Mr. Todd, you may proceed, and you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. Let me start with a few facts. Clifford Mellon died October 30th, 2003. At the time of his death, he was in the nursing home, and he was on a long-term care payment plan under Medicaid since about 1999. Clifford's sister, Alice, died October 1, 1997. At the time of her death, there were numerous joint bank accounts, some of which named Clifford as joint tenant, beneficiary, payable on death person. Those joint accounts were accounted for in Alice's estate. They were not part of the probate, but accounted for it, and that was back in the inheritance, South Dakota inheritance tax days, and so those were accounted for those purposes. And in fact, some of the CDs that would have went to Cliff were actually cash to pay for Cliff's share of in the South Dakota inheritance tax.
So what happened to the rest of them all this time? Alice is dead, Clifford's in the nursing home, and you have these CDs. Did they just sit there?
It appears from the record that those CDs were just maintained in a bank or several banks in the original form that they were invested in, maintained by family. Some of them, I believe, maintained the same account names. They weren't actually converted into or changed names. They just stayed in those original form.
Okay. You mean they would have been in Alice's name and then, say, Clifford as a joint tenant or a joint tenant with right of survivorship?
That's my understanding.
Now, were these actual joint tenancy CDs or were they payable on death?
They were a mix.
Oh, okay.
Some of both.
Legally, is there a difference for our purposes?
Under the code, I don't believe they are. Under, I think, 29A6, either way, as a matter of law, upon death, they become the property of the survivor.
Okay. Because clearly, as long as Alice is alive, apparently Clifford attempted to exercise no control or nobody on his behalf over these CDs. They were apparently Alice's, I guess.
I believe that's what the record indicates. They were her monies invested. He didn't exercise any ownership, and so they were properly accounted for as her assets in inheritance tax provisions, et cetera.
So they were taxed to Alice's estate?
During that process, yes.
Okay.
I mean, they were itemized out as joint tenancy property instead of probate assets, but handled in that process, yes.
Okay.
All right, so Alice died in October of 1997, and then she has this property, and Clifford is in the nursing home, and he dies in October of 2003, right?
That's correct.
So that property is going to him, and the issue is whether or not the Department of Social Services, who provided care for Clifford, is entitled to have their claim paid by Clifford's estate now after he's received this property from Alice.
That's correct. I mean, the state's position is that's his assets now. They vested in him as part of his estate.
Okay. Now, for the benefit of our students here, would you explain what a disclaimer is?
A disclaimer is a process authorized under the state code. I believe it's 29A2801. Which allows a party to, as the word indicates, disclaim. In other words, I don't want that property. And so then it reverts back to the In this case, it reverts back to Alice's estate. I suppose there's other avenues of where it would go to, but in this particular setting, it would revert back to her estate.
Okay, so then the question is, if it reverts back to Alice's estate, if the disclaimer was properly done, it reverts back to Alice's estate before the claim of the Department of Social Services attaches, so then Clifford's estate wouldn't have to pay for the medical bills.
I believe that's correct. If it would have been made within the nine-month time frame, the statute indicates, I believe it's 29A2801C, that it's considered retroactive. And so under those grounds, the proper argument, I believe, would be, yes, it is as if it never vested, and so therefore the claim would never have been able to attach to those assets.
Okay, but this wasn't disclaimed until like 7 years after Alice died.
That's correct.
Okay, so how do you get the benefit of the statute under those circumstances?
Under subsection I of 801, it says those assets now, because they're not within the nine-month time frame, become an assignment. And so those assets do actually vest. They were actually Clifford's assets. They still go back to Alice's estate to be handled, but we don't get the retroactive effect. So
right. So don't they go back subject to the claim of the department?
Exactly. That's the position that the state takes, and I believe consistent with statute, that those claims then attach. And so they have to be paid before that assignment can be transferred. The money left through that assignment can be transferred by the PR.
Right.
Is the assignment, is that defined in statute at all, what an assignment is?
I believe it's included in some of the transfer statutes, real estate, personal property transfer statutes.
Does it talk about ownership or anything of that nature?
I don't recall that ownership, the term ownership is included in those
something
phraseologies.
Comparable.
Yep. Excuse me, 8A1 refers to transfers, and it includes disposing of or parting with an asset or an interest in an asset. That doesn't actually use either the term assignment or ownership, but it seems to be broad enough to close any type of possession, ownership, authority over that.
So really you're relying, as far as assignment in property law, you're relying here on a definition from Black's Law Dictionary as opposed to anything in statute or case law. Is that right?
I cited Black's law and one of the cases connected in my brief under, as just referenced, 54.8 and 54.8A, I believe there's references to transfers. Assignment would be included in that general term, which would then fall into the void or voidable statutes.
Well, it seems to me that the issue here is whether this assignment is actually goes through the estate or not. And it seems like the definition of it, you know, disclaimer would not actually come to the estate and be, he would have no ability to or ownership of that if it's disclaimed. If it's an assignment, is it this? I mean, can you assign a disclaimer? I guess with assignment, do you have to have some kind of ownership in it?
I believe it's clear that because this isn't, in a sense, a disclaimer now, because it's past the 9 months, it's an assignment. That means that Clifford owned these assets. He's got the authority, and of course, now his PR on his behalf has the ability to assign those or transfer those out of his ownership, his control. And that's why the attachment, in a sense, applies there from any creditor. I mean, in this case, it's department. It's the state of South Dakota for Medicaid payments, but it would apply as to any creditor if they'd had claims, that those would have to be recognized before they could be, those monies could be signed out.
At the proceedings involving Clifford's estate, was there any argument to the court that the monies were not actually owed by Clifford to the state of South Dakota for his care when he was living? Or is that a given?
In the circuit court level, there was absolutely no discussion that those monies were not due. In fact, there was references that that was kind of the purpose of the disclaimer to start with, is so that they wouldn't have to pay that. Of course, as another note, at the circuit court level, the only thing that was noticed for hearing was the petition for allowance of disclaimer. The state had filed a petition for allowance of claim, and we had done that in order to comply with statutory requirements, so we had 60 days to do that after the denial of our claim. But that wasn't actually brought on for a hearing. The primary issue, of course, was disclaimer. If it's approved, there's nothing left in the estate. It's insolvent, so the allowance is moot.
Okay, thank you.
So where did the trial court go wrong in your view?
Excuse me?
Where did the trial judge go wrong in your view?
Well, I think first off, it went wrong because it's not within the best interest of the estate. And that for a couple reasons. It's also wrong because the assignment that's allowed under 29A2801J, that can be done. I mean, if it's in the best interest of the estate, I believe the court has the ability to say, okay, I'm going to allow the assignment, but that assignment can't be to cut off every claim. And that was part of the order. He says just flat out cut off any claim by the state of South Dakota in that assignment. And
so he let the assignment go be retroactive.
Yes.
Effectively, which the statute does not allow that. Is that right?
That's correct. He didn't use the term retroactive, but in a sense that's what ultimately happened because he put in the clause in the order and denying all claims by the state.
I take it that all we have here is a legal question before us. There's no factual disputes as to what happened here at all. That
As it relates to the interpretation of whether it's retroactive or the assignment, yes, that's a legal issue.
So we give the trial court no deference as far as the way the case comes up to us.
That's everything's correct.
De novo.
Panel de novo.
Okay.
You know, I didn't quite understand what the trial court's reasoning was for saying that this assignment occurred without free and clear, I should say, of this $113,000 claim. I mean, I couldn't see what law the court was trying to apply to say that it didn't attach, that the claim didn't attach.
Well,
what was argued? I mean, what was the... I couldn't see it in the record that I read.
I want to be respectful of the court, but I couldn't see anything in the transcript. It wasn't argued, and I couldn't find anything in the facts that actually gave a basis of why all of a sudden you can say, I'm going to approve the assignment, and I'm going to cut off the state. And in fact, from the transcript of the judge's comments that we have, it would have seemed that there's a little bit more wiggle room to say, well, I'm going to grant the assignment, but... we're not talking about the state's petition for allowance. But then when the actual findings of fact and order came out, it said it just cut off the state's claim, free and clear of the state's claim. So I can't find a basis for...
You don't recall a theory being argued?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Was it argued to the court by you and your opponent? After you tried the matter or presented it, did you argue your respective positions to the court?
Let me think about that a minute. I know that it seemed like the whole substance of the argument and the testimony was the best interests of Alice Milan's estate. And of course, The state's position is that's irrelevant. I mean, we're talking about Clifford's estate. I know that towards the end in the argument we talked about what consequence that would have if the disclaimer was made, and whether that would, in a sense, require Alice's estate to reopen and readjust inheritance tax issues, because now all of a sudden it's not going to Clifford, it's going to other parties. And so would that require that to do so, the consequences of it? I'm not able to probably point a finger to a specific spot in the transcript that would say answer question.
Alice's estate is not part of this appeal. Did they participate in this argument at all at Circuit Court? Or is it just you and Clifford's estate?
Well, the hearing involved Clifford's estate, but actually the only testimony at the Circuit Court level was the testimony of Alice Milan's personal representative. And that's why I was commenting that we seem to get absorbed by what's the best interests of Alice's estate. Well, it doesn't make any difference what she wanted. It was Clifford's vested property. The statute says we look at the best interest of the party trying to disclaim. And so it doesn't make any difference what Alice wanted.
But this vested property that you're talking about, though, why didn't that come to light during any of the application process that Clifford was making to receive these funds from the state?
That's interesting to me, too, and I don't want to talk disparagingly about the family, but when I reviewed the application for long-term care so he could be approved for Medicaid, and then, of course, there's a requirement that it's annual updates, there's no reference, there's no mention, there's no indication that there are these joint accounts out there that were Clifford's estate. Had they been there, he would not have been approved for those. It wasn't until the notice came from Clifford's estate to DSS by statute that tells if you got a claim, we file their claim, that then they ultimately filed this disclaimer, and we realized, man, there was money out there that should have been used for his care before he ever got Medicaid services.
How did you find that out? How did you find that out?
When, as required by statute, the PR for Clifford's estate sent notice to DSS that Clifford had died. So then we run a tally on our Medicaid list and find out, oh, Clifford has received Medicaid benefits. So as a matter of course, we send back to the estate a statement of claim. And then about 3 or 4 months later, they file this petition for disclaimer, which itemizes out the monies that are there.
When did he become eligible for Medicaid?
If my recall is correct, I think it was September, October of 1999.
And then when did he actually receive? When did she die? What was the date of the...
Alice Milan died October 1st of 1997.
Okay.
So it was about 2 years after she died. So those properties would have been available for Cliff for approximately 2 years before he applied.
He could have spent them, dissipated, or done anything he wanted with before he had to go to DSS.
Exactly. Now, I understand he was in the nursing home before she died, was paying for his care out of his own resources, own earned incomes, etc. It wasn't until approximately 99 that assets which were normally considered his earnings throughout his lifetime exhausted, and so then he applied.
Okay.
Judge Gilbertson, you inquired earlier about the de novo issue. The best interest issue, I believe, actually out of fairness, is a clear and convincing or a clearly erroneous standard. I mean, the court has some discretion in making that judgment. That's one of the issues which we have raised. And it's interesting to note that if this property goes back to Alice's estate, you look at her will and how it's to be distributed, and that's not the same distribution as it would be if it went under Clifford's will. So it would appear to me like you can't claim that it's in the best interest of Clifford to disclaim if by allowing that, different people are allowed to get assets. For instance, under his will, he gives assets to 4 of his 5 children. I'm not sure why he disclaimed one, but one is specifically not listed on distribution. But he adds in that he lists Jane Milland as an ex-daughter-in-law, as a recipient. If it goes to Alice's estate, her estate says it's divided equally between her 4 brothers or to their heirs. So they lose 3/4 of that disclaimer to aunts and uncles and cousins before it gets to Clifford's family. And then Gary, who is the disinherited son, all of a sudden is not disclaimed under Alice's will, so he gets a share when it appears Clifford doesn't want him to, and Jane Milland gets nothing. She gets totally disinherited if it goes back to Alice's estate.
Does that make any difference? Do you even have to get to that issue if you call it an assignment?
Well, the court has to first rule whether it's in the best interest of the estate to authorize this.
To authorize a disclaimer or an assignment?
Either. I mean, the statute is generic, so I mean, if it was within the 9 months, it has to be under the best interest. If it's after, it also does.
Okay.
But
thank
even
you.
If it's, if I'm sorry.
Okay. Oh, you want to follow up?
That's fine.
Okay, thank you. Time has expired.
Thank you.
Mr. Nielsen, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, Gordon Nielsen for the estate of Clifford Mellon. This case deals primarily with the interpretation of SDCL 29A-2-801, South Dakota's disclaimer statute. There's no question that the disclaimer filed in the estate of Clifford Mellon was filed well outside of the 9-month time period contemplated in subparagraph C of that statute. But the disclaimer is authorized by statute. Subparagraph I of the statute specifically authorizes disclaimers made outside of the 9-month window. And that's what happened in this case. The estate of Clifford Mellon filed a petition for approval of disclaimer. They needed court approval, as indicated in subsection J of that statute, and the trial court agreed that the disclaimer was in the estate's best interest and authorized the disclaimer.
How could it possibly be in the best interest of the estate for the reasons that have just been stated? I mean, Clifford's estate is going to lose a lot more than if they'd have just taken the money, that have been better off than if it goes back to Alice's estate and goes to some of the same heirs. So how could it possibly be in the best interest of Clifford's estate?
Well, Justice Sabers, it's in the best interest of Clifford's estate in that there is a $113,000 claim that's been filed by the Department of Social Services that needed to be addressed first. The heirs of Clifford's estate and the heirs of Alice's estate are primarily the same individuals. Obviously, it would be in the best interest of the estate to avoid the Medicaid claim, if at all possible.
So that's the one sole reason that Judge Flemmer give that reason why it was in the best interest? Because then theoretically you can avoid the Medicaid claim?
Well, I think it's important to consider why disclaimers are used historically. Why do people utilize disclaimers? Oftentimes to avoid a debt or to avoid negative tax implications. If we weren't trying to avoid a debt or negative tax implications, a party could always accept the debt or accept the asset and then assign it to where they see fit. So I don't want to leave this court with the impression that we're trying, or that the estate was trying to cheat the system. I think we're just taking advantage of
what other reason are you using?
Excuse me, Justice Abrams?
What other reason is it in the best interest of the estate?
Well, I think it's in the best interest of the estate to get the most resources that we can to the heirs of Clifford Mellon.
Now, you say that there's no attempt here to cheat the state, yet for 2 years between when Alice dies and when Clifford goes on DSS, there is no attempt by Clifford or any person in his family to go get those CDs, which they could have presumably gotten on demand from Alice's personal rep, and they fail to list those as an asset when they apply for DSS assistance.
Justice Gilbertson, I think the key to answering that question is looking at Alice's will. Now, I acknowledge that that's not part of this this proceeding, but in Alice's will, she specifically said that she wanted her property to go to her brothers, with the exception of Clifford. In her will, she said, I acknowledge Clifford is in the nursing home. I don't want my money to go to Clifford. I want it to go to his children, her Stirpes.
But of course,
I think when Clifford and his children read the will, they were under the impression that the will dictated where these assets were to go. I think they are probably erroneous in making that conclusion, but that was their thought process. Upon Clifford's passing in 2003, they brought this matter to my attention. I informed them that there's a difference between probate property and non-probate property, and I told them that the proper way in which to handle this would be then to disclaim Clifford's assets and start an estate, and we did that, and that's the notice. Then we were required to give notice to the department, and that's where we ended up today.
Were there any other debts that were claimed as part of this estate amount?
Not that I'm aware of.
So this was the main claim.
The assets of the estate were these assets that were coming from the estate of Alice Mellon, and the debt was the debt of the Department of Social Services.
Explain to me. I guess I'm still a little confused here. It seems to me that if this becomes an assignment, nobody disagrees that it was beyond the 9 month, correct? For the
correct
disclaimer. So under the statute, then it becomes an assignment.
I don't agree with that. No.
Okay, now explain to me why you don't think that's what statute says.
I think it's important to take into consideration that this is not an assignment. If you look at subsection K of that statute, it says if it is an assignment, the attempted disclaimer is invalidated. That's subsection 1 of subsection K of 2-801. So this cannot be an assignment. If it's an assignment, the attempted disclaimer is invalidated on its face.
So if we rule this as an assignment, you lose.
I lose. My clients lose.
But the other statute says...
Excuse me. I don't agree with that.
You want to take that back?
Okay. Can I answer that question, Justice
sure.
Inter? I think the state's interpretation or the department's interpretation of subsection I says that it shall be construed as an assignment, period. And that's not what the statute says. The statute says it shall be construed as an assignment of the interest disclaimed to the person who would be entitled to take. It's saying, where did this property going to go? It says we have a disclaimer that shall be treated or construed as an assignment, and then it says where this property is to go. Then we have to go back to subsection C to say, where does this property go? Since this is a joint asset, it goes as if Clifford had predeceased Alice.
Well, that's controlled by 29A2801.1. It says a disclaimer not made within the time limits prescribed by this section shall be construed as an assignment of the interest disclaimed to the persons who would be entitled to take had the disclaimer been timely made. In other words, as if Clifford had predeceased Alice. That statute's directly against your position, as I see it.
Can you phrase that, Justice Sabres?
That statute.
And you're referring to subsection I?
Yes. Yes. Because of the interest disclaimed goes to the persons who would be entitled to take had the disclaimer been timely made.
Exactly. It's saying, where does this property? It goes to the same place it would go if the...
It goes as if Clifford died first and Alice's heirs get it.
Correct.
Okay. So But it's not retroactive in the sense that it can void the claim of Medicaid.
I think it does, Justice Sabers. And the reason I think that it's construed as an assignment and not actually an assignment, I think the key to this case is, did Clifford ever take dominion and control over the asset? If he had taken dominion and control over the asset and then he assigned it, certainly the claim would attach. But the common law is very clear. There's case law from this court that says we can't force an inheritance on a person. There's three parts to a gift. There's the intent, there's the delivery, and the acceptance. In this case, Clifford Mellon never accepted the gift, if he would have, or the inheritance. If he would have accepted it, certainly the claims would have attached.
But subsection I requires us to look at it and construe it as an assignment. Whether, in fact, it actually occurred or not seems to be irrelevant. The statute says it shall be construed as an assignment.
I think the statute, Justice Sinter, says it shall be construed as an assignment of the interest disclaim to the persons who would be entitled. I don't think it's construed as an assignment, meaning the assignment as defined in subsection K1. I think it just says, here's where the property is going to go. And then we have to look at subparagraph C to determine where that property is going to go. I guess I would respectfully disagree with that position. I think there's a...
How can you assign, though? How can you get... The assign assumes that you have some ownership or ability to direct where to direct an asset. So how do you get past the ownership part of assignment?
And I think it's a confusing part of this statute. I think we have to agree that it's not an assignment. I think if it was an assignment, we'd have to look at Section K. So it's got to be something different than an assignment. Otherwise, I can't see the purpose of the legislature putting in that K1. I think it has to be something different. I think we have to assume that the legislature knew what they were doing when they put it in. And I think if the legislature wanted the assignment to be subject to a creditor's claim, certainly they could have put that in there. In 29A-3, 801 through 817, there's 17 statutes there where the legislature talks about claims, what we're going to do with claims, how we're going to treat claims. They know about claims. They've got 17 statutes on point. They didn't put it here, and I think there's a reason they didn't put it here. I think we also have to look at subparagraph A of this statute, and it says, that last line in subparagraph A, it says that a person shall have the right to disclaim irrevocably the whole or any part of such property or beneficial interest. I think the statute says we have the right to disclaim. Subsection 8 says nothing in this section shall prevent the making of a disclaimer in any lawful manner. And then subsection I, the next one, says if it's after 9 months, here's what you do. But I think it's correct. I think it's also important to note in this case that the department filed a claim. There's no question that the department filed a claim. And the estate filed a notice of disallowance of claim. There was a hearing on this matter. Following the hearing, the trial court entered a order indicating that the petition for allowance of claim by the State of South Dakota Department of Social Services is hereby denied. The state denied that claim. At this hearing, or in this proceeding, clearly the estate has the right to file a disallowance of claim. I think 29A-2-806 says the estate has the right to file a notice of disallowance of claim. When we have a hearing on that matter, it is the department that has the burden of proof of establishing their claim. In the estate of Malone, cited in my brief, it says it's the claimant, not the estate, that has the burden of proof. In the Mahan case, it says a claimant's burden of proof before the trial court is by clear and convincing evidence. There was no evidence presented at the trial court in support of the department's claim. The judge asked as follows, Mr. Todd, do you have any testimony? And Mr. Todd indicated the state has no witnesses. There was no evidence presented.
Well, the $113,000, that's not in dispute, is it?
Well, I think it is. It potentially is in dispute. And the reason I say that, Justice Inter, is just prior to the hearing, the department filed a memorandum in support of the petition for allowance of claim. And in that memorandum, they indicate on page 2 of that memorandum that the estate, or that the department, is entitled to $133,000. So they've got a, obviously I hope that's not the case, But they have a petition filed for $113,000. They file a memorandum in support of their of petition for claim for $133,000. So are they wrong $23,000 or $20,000 this way? Or maybe it was $20,000 the other way. Certainly they should have to prove that up.
Were they asking for interest on their claim?
Not to my knowledge.
Well, if I understand Mr. Todd's scenario of the facts, if we reverse, the DSS would still have to prove the claim up. That's never been done.
Well, I think that they had the opportunity to do that. The trial court denied the claim, and the state never appealed that issue.
The basis for the denial was not that DSS didn't furnish the services, but because of the disclaimer. Correct?
I'm not positive on that, Justice Gilbertson. I think they had an opportunity to prove their claim, and they failed to do that. Arguably, that would be a res judicata issue, I would assume. If they would have offered the claim into evidence, obviously I could have made an argument, lack of foundation, a hearsay-style argument, and we could have had a ruling on whether or not the claim itself constituted proper evidence. But there is no evidence to support the state's claim. So I don't know how the trial judge could have found any different on that issue. With regard to the best interest of the estate, the only testimony that was presented at the hearing with regard to the best interest of the estate was the testimony of Robert Mellon, who is the son of Clifford Mellon. Also, the person who filed the disclaimer, Marjorie Harn, is another child of Clifford Mellon. Those are the only people that presented anything to the court for their consideration with regard to the best interest. Notice was properly given. No one filed an objection. No evidence was presented by the state that it wasn't in the estate's best interest. I have not been able to find anything statutorily that would define what an assignment is either, Justice Meyer Henry. I do call your attention to section 43-4-16 and 43-4-17 that talks about a grant or an interest in property. That's the closest thing that I could find other than black law, a black law dictionary definition of what an assignment is. Subject to any questions that you have, that's all I have.
No one has ever chastised for quitting early.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nielsen. Mr. Todd, you have 10 minutes, sir.
I'll try not to use it. Briefly, as to the best interest factor, I did a little calculations, and it would appear to me that we're talking about a disclaimer of approximately $166,000 or $167,000, rounded to an even number. If that goes back to Alice's estate, and it's divided four ways because there's four of her brothers, and then Clifford's family gets a fourth of that, and there's five children, they'll each end up with about $8,350. That's without cost, but that's just round figures. If I use that same $167,000 that's disclaimed, the Clifford Milland estate first pays DSS. Their claim is rounded up approximately to $116,000. There's $53,000 left to distribute. You divide that five ways according to Clifford's direction in his will, those five recipients get $10,600. If for some reason Gary comes in under the guise that he was improperly disinherited, even if we divide that six ways, everybody gets $8,800. So actually, people get more money by paying the state's claim. Opposing counsel commented about subsection K. I think in context, the only way you can read subsection K is if at the time of the attempted disclaimer, there is a prior assignment, transfer, act of ownership that somehow negates the court's ability to say you fit into the guise or the ability to disclaim. You can't read section I that talks about having a and construed as an assignment as an automatic violation of subparagraph K. That would somehow allow a statute to void itself.
What's the state's interest in whether or not it's in the best interest of the estate? I still am wondering why the state's interested in that particular issue, one way or the other. If this court finds that it's an assignment and that it goes into the estate, what does it matter to you? You'll get it either way, won't you?
Well, if it is an assignment and we're allowed to get our claim before the assignment is paid, you're right. It doesn't make any difference.
If it isn't an assignment, it goes into the estate. So either way, you're going to get it.
Well.
Right? So what does it matter whether you get in? I mean, what does it matter to the state whether the court made this determination of it, whether it's in the best interest of the estate or not?
Because if for some reason the assignment can be construed so that the creditor, in this case the department, is not paid, then of course the court under paragraph J has to decide it's in the best interest. So, I mean, we would prefer it stays in Clifford's estate so there's an easy transition to get our claim paid. If the assignment under J is authorized as an assignment, then we have to go after the recipient of that assignment. So then we have to initiate proceedings against Alice's estate or the people that take those assets.
So if we would say that it isn't in the best interest, we'd have to find that the trial court was clearly erroneous in some of its findings.
That's correct. And I acknowledge that. That's a higher burden in that finding. And then in closing, the petition for allowance, as indicated again, if you'll note the appeal record, there is no notice on that hearing. The notice specifically says a notice of hearing on the petition for a disclaimer. The petition for allowance of claim has never come before the court to be heard. And actually, in the transcript, the judge specifically said that's for another day. That's all I have.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Carr.
You very much. Thanks for allowing me to be here.
Court will be in recess until 10 o'clock.